Hello, this is Caroline Jones with The Search for Meaning.
And I think over a period of time, it just got so wearisome, so tiresome, to be forcing everything to fit in this black and white view of the world, so that was just so rigid. There wasn't enough flexibility or openness or creativity or interest anymore to try to make everything forcibly fit. And you can imagine, you know, forcing pieces of a puzzle to fit when they don't. And so to me, it ended up being a matter of integrity to just let go.
But it must have been hard too, I suppose, to turn your back on what had been so much an all-encompassing system of belief for so many years.
Very difficult and painful.
Yes.
I mean, I think of Jesus as my first lover. So, yes, very painful.
Dr. Marlene Winnell, a psychologist with a doctorate in human development and family studies, and the author of a book written from hard personal experience, Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. Marlene Winnell is interested in the dangers of certain forms of religious indoctrination and the reclaiming of a healthy human spirit. It's an important social question with wide implications for two reasons, I think. First, because so many people today have walked away from the religion of their childhood and have searched out or constructed or been seduced by other frameworks of meaning. And secondly, because fundamentalism is alive and well in the world today, and I mean in economics and politics and nationalism as well as in religion. So it's as well to have some understanding of what attitudes and behaviour fundamentalism produces. It's a rigid dogmatism which knows itself to be right and permits of no open discussion about ideas. For example, in the case of the religious fundamentalism in which Marlene Winnell was raised, efforts to improve society are considered futile because the world will soon end, according to the Bible, which is taken literally word for word, and only the righteous, the saved, will be raptured up to heaven. But of course it offers comforts too, the reassurance of certainty and of structure imposed on chaos. The comfort of an all-encompassing framework of meaning with an answer for everything, as long as you don't ask questions of it. It's a style of religion gaining popularity in these fast-changing, complex, uncertain times, as people look for an infallible map to chart their course. And it's appealing to many young people, for whom the future looks peculiarly hopeless. Marlene Winnell was brought up in China in a missionary family which preached and practiced a fundamentalist religion. But there came a point when her reason, her experience, and her education made her confront the religion of her childhood and break free from it to find more expansive, more satisfying sources of meaning. As my guest in this edition of The Search for Meaning, Dr. Marlene Winnell analyzes her experience and tells a painful story of the loss of certainty and the gaining of integrity.
My memories have to do with the tropical climate and the Chinese environment, the Taiwanese environment, going away to boarding school, my parents being busy with their missionary work, thinking a lot all the time about spiritual questions, religious questions, reading the Bible, because it was very important that each of us made these kinds of decisions ourselves, and it was a personal thing, so I took that very seriously.
What were the main religious beliefs of your family, of your parents?
Well, they were with Assemblies of God, and that is a charismatic fundamentalist church, and so the beliefs are those of other fundamentalist churches. The world is very black and white. There's also a literal belief in the Bible, every word being dictated by God, to the point where some people think that fundamentalists worship the Bible instead of God, but that's very central.
And Marlene, can you recall now, what were your feelings about Jesus Christ as a child?
Oh, I was a very sincere Christian myself, and read the Bible and took everything very seriously, prayed, frustrated a lot of the time, thinking that I was not living up to what I should. The ideals are pretty high. One problem with the belief system is that whenever there's any good happening or when you do something good yourself, God seems to get all the credit. God would get credit for a painting I did, or good grades, or anything that was positive. But if there were problems, if I was having a fight with my sister, that was our fault, and we were the ones that were sinning.
So it sounds as though there's a feeling of being unacceptable fairly constantly with you. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that you can't trust yourself. And that's, I think, one of the basic problems that I talk about the most in my book is that, and the biggest area of healing is to learn to really respect and trust yourself, that you are not at core bad. So I couldn't do that. I couldn't trust myself, always looking to God for guidance. I think the biggest problem was just not being allowed to question, not being allowed to think for ourselves. If you raised too many questions, you weren't seen as having honest issues coming from a sincere heart, but it would eventually be interpreted as doubt and sin. So you learn to keep quiet and simply agonize over problems that you have privately.
And did you live with an expectation of the imminent end of the world?
Not on a daily basis. I don't think we worried about it daily. Although in my own private study, I could see from reading Revelations and from reading the tone of some of the epistles especially, the Bible talks a lot about the end of the world, and I privately got very interested in that question and did a lot of research and even wrote huge papers about it when I was in junior high school on my own time. My grandfather was also a missionary, and he wrote a lot about this. And when I was 15, I spent one day a week praying and fasting and things like that.
And you kept a spiritual diary. I wondered what sort of hopes or dreams or ideas you were writing into that diary as a teenager.
I did have a fairly major event when I was 13, which was when I experienced what Pentecostals call the infilling of the Spirit. And I spoke in tongues for about 45 minutes, although it felt like 10 minutes. A lot of emotion, crying, huge catharsis.
This was in church?
No, this was at home. One evening after a church service, I came home and the evangelist who had been leading the service was staying with us at our family's home. And we came back from the service, and he prayed with me in our living room. No one else was home. Very gentle old man who I had a really nice little talk with. And then we prayed. And I had been what they call seeking the infilling of the Spirit, seeking the Spirit for some time because I'd heard about it and seen other people. And in Pentecostal circles, it's something that everyone aspires to.
I want us now to sing in the Holy Ghost. Lord, those that know how to sing in the Holy Ghost just for a minute or two, let's sing in the Holy Ghost. And the Holy Spirit is going to fall on these people here in front. And many of you are going to burst forth, praising the Lord in new languages as the Holy Spirit gives you utterance. Because now you qualify. Now you qualify to receive the baptism into the Holy Spirit.
So then it happened for me privately, which actually I think was very good because I would have been a lot more suspicious if it had been a crowd scene, which sometimes happens.
What else can you say about what that experience was? You mentioned speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm.
Was it like an altered state?
Oh, very definitely. Very definitely an altered state. Very much like the experiences that mystics from a lot of religions talk about, a sense of losing your individual self, a unity with the infinite, a sense of coming home, of belonging, of being ultimately loved. At the time, I interpreted it as just being in God's presence with nothing in between, as if I had died and gone to heaven, uniting with God.
An ecstatic experience.
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. And then after that, being able to draw on it pretty constantly. Speaking in tongues is a very pleasurable and interesting experience. It's part of the altered state that you can get into, similar to other kinds of altered states. And then relaxing the vocal cords and mouth, tongue, to allow yourself to express yourself emotionally and without using words. So I guess you could compare it to some kind of expressive dancing or something like that, and just to let yourself go and move without controlling or planning anything.
Yes.
There's been research on speaking in tongues that's kind of interesting, and as to whether or not they are languages or not, you know, it's debatable. One interesting thing is that someone who has spoken in tongues in the past, even though they've left the faith, can often still do it. And that's true for me, too.
Hmm.
And that's very strange.
Hmm.
So, in other words, it's an interpretation to say that it's the Holy Spirit in the biblical kind of sense, as in the Book of Acts when it was described there for the apostles.
Yes.
And it's interpretation to connect it just with that.
I'm not sure whether you're saying that looking back now, you would see that experience as having been a genuine mystical experience. I mean, whatever that might mean.
Oh, I think it was something unusual and could very well have been a very deep mystical experience. And it wasn't the only time. After that, I was able to enter this kind of ecstatic state in my own private prayer life many times. And a lot of people have done that. I mean, there have been mystics in church history that have written a lot about that.
Yes.
And that was very much very important to me as a teenager. And I think my intimate relationship with God and these kinds of connections probably got me through my adolescence in some ways, strengthening me and giving me hope and all that.
In a family of seven, I think you were about in the middle of that family of seven, were your emotional needs met pretty well? It's a lot of children.
I wouldn't say that emotional needs were met for a number of reasons. I think some of it was religiously based, in that there are certain family dysfunctions that are typical for a fundamentalist family, such as not welcoming the expression of feelings, not trying to nurture self-esteem in the children, respecting them as individuals and nurturing their growth and all of that. But it was also a big family with parents that were both very busy, and not just busy with their jobs, like many parents are, but busy saving the world, busy converting the heathen. As a child, you really can't compete with that. If you're convinced that they are doing God's work, there's not much you can say about that if you feel like you're not getting enough time.
Mm. So looking back from this vantage point, and of course with the benefit of your education and clinical practice in psychology, a doctorate in human development and family studies, what would you want to say about the religious influence on your formation as a person, both negative and positive?
There were definitely strengths and liabilities. I think a child growing up in a religious environment, if it's not just a formality to go to church, but the questions are really handled seriously, I think that you learn to address very big questions and consider life in a very broad kind of way, and that the future of the world is important, relationships are important, a lot of issues are truly important to consider. There's a selflessness that you learn, a gentleness. I think Jesus was a model of maleness, different from a lot of macho males that we have in our culture. So I think sometimes the men were different. They didn't mind talking about love. They didn't mind crying and interesting things like that. So there were a number of strengths. As I got into it, I realized how many there were. And it was very uplifting to think about, and as I've worked with people who have wanted to heal and grow, it's been important to have some of these as an anchor, that there have been some important lessons. Awareness of mercy.
What do you mean by that?
Unlike the vengeful God of the Old Testament, which people sometimes think of, the idea of atonement, grace, forgiveness, the idea of people not being perfect and that salvation is not about trying to be perfect. I have a personal theory that the salvation experience that is described in Christian terms is actually an experience of self-acceptance. And that, in effect, when you accept God's forgiveness in the Christian terminology, you're getting a stamp of approval from higher up, and you can then accept yourself. And that kind of self-love, that kind of self-acceptance is so hard to come by. People have a real hard time with that. So that the religion provides a way of doing that.
So what would you say about your religious upbringing that had a negative effect?
Well, the easiest way to summarize would be self-love and self-trust. I don't think that those were encouraged or taught. I think it has taken me a long time to learn what that means. And when you are partially guilty for the death of Christ and for the fall of mankind, that's a very heavy thing. I think that's a very, very heavy thing to put on children. And then once you are saved, you owe your life, and you owe everything good about life to God. That's kind of a heavy sense of gratitude. And it's not very empowering. It is on the surface. It is in a sense, because, you know, there are verses that say, you know, all things are possible through Christ, and you think of yourself as a channel for God to work through, and you can feel blessed in that way, used in that way. But in terms of thinking about yourself, your core self and who you are, your own identity, the teaching is basically that you are not to trust that, and as soon as you do, you're on very shaky ground. And as soon as you stop depending on God. So there's really a dependency fostered that I think is just unhealthy. What I realized was that I was replacing, or I was filling in for things that I wasn't getting from my family life. God was my parent, and I got a lot of my emotional needs met that way. So in that sense, I was very dependent on that, more like a child is dependent on a parent.
Radio National, The Search for Meaning, Caroline Jones with you, and my guest is psychologist Dr. Marlene Winnell, author of Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. So what were some of the factors in your leaving the fold? How long did that take? And what were the questions which eventually the fundamentalist Christianity could not answer for you? How did the changes begin?
The whole process was so gradual. I don't think I knew when it was happening. The early stages, I don't think I knew I was changing. I think that's true probably for a lot of people. One enormous area would be just the input of new information. As I got older, as an older teenager, and then in college, finding out more about other points of view, meeting new people, getting to know people from other worldviews, other religions, taking courses in college, finding out that maybe the world isn't totally fallen, stupid, crazy, evil. Being intelligent and interested and curious enough to pursue that, and getting increasingly uncomfortable with a one-way attitude.
And what were some of the specific ways in which your college education began to challenge the teachings of fundamentalist religion about the nature of the human person?
Well, any kind of studies in the humanities, reading literature and philosophy and the history of science and psychology, and coming in contact with humanism, I think in particular, the idea that you can think about humans as basically good, and that there's an entire philosophy around that that makes coherent sense. In psychology, learning more about human change processes and learning, and how a lot of problems that people deal with are problems that have developed in the course of their lives for good reason, and that there can be ways of changing. For example, having a bad temper. Somebody in my family who was constantly having problems with a bad temper, having it always being attributed to sin, the formula always being the same, to confess the sin, to take it to God, to have God heal it, God change you. And no matter what your problem was, whether it was loneliness or depression or acne, it would be something to pray about and have God deal with. And if you continue to have the problem, then it was clearly your fault. You were not praying enough about it, and the answer would just be more of the same. Being introduced to other ways of going about problem solving, like if you're having a problem with anger, to go about that in a much different way, trying to understand what's going on and deal with problems differently.
And Marlene, what role did your marriage play in all of this change? Mm. How is that important?
Well, another aspect of the change was human relationships. Like I said, I was totally dependent on God for emotional sustenance, getting closer to people, and then having my first real intimate relationship with the man that I married, I think broke whatever addiction you might say I had, in the sense of feeling loved in a very real, concrete way, and noticing that I didn't need to pray as much, I didn't need to be as religious as I was, because I was getting something very, very present, very real on a daily basis.
And do you think a change from thinking of love more particularly in spiritual terms to a physical love also would have been an important component in that?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. There are a lot of hymns and about the arms of God and hands holding you and all these kinds of things, but they aren't real arms and hands. And when somebody's really holding you, that's a pretty, pretty big event.
It all sounds like a fairly long and slow process. I wondered, at what age would you have ceased calling yourself a Christian?
That's really hard to say. I've thought about this question, and it's hard to answer because there's a ambiguous time when you don't say one way or the other. I don't think I was answering the question because I couldn't say it out loud. I do remember one time when I'd say I was probably 32, when I finally said it out loud to somebody that I was no longer a Christian. In fact, I said it to a minister who I had known from years before, and he asked me what church I was going to and what I was doing. And I came right out with it. I said, well, I'm not a Christian anymore. And then I proceeded to say that I thought I was closer to God than ever and that I was very happy, to the point where he backed away and found somebody else to talk to. But that was a very startling kind of experience, because I came away thinking, I said it out loud. And people ask me that a lot, you know, whether just not being a fundamentalist anymore means that I'm no longer Christian. And I think that I'm still Christian in the sense of some of the values and some of the cultural background. But to me, Christian, the word, was wrapped up in being Christian and nothing else.
Yes.
It's a very exclusive word, and it's kind of calcified like that for me.
Yes.
So I wouldn't use that word for myself. When I think of how I left and why, I sometimes think of like a jigsaw puzzle where the pieces are no longer fitting. Also the struggle in trying to make the pieces fit. And I see other people going through this too. And I remember confronting things like feminism and then noticing the patriarchal practices in the church and being uncomfortable with that. Or finding out something about the history of the Bible and comparing that to the way we thought about the Bible being inerrantly inspired and so forth. And I think for many years it was just uncomfortable, and I would try to rationalize. I remember in an anthropology class writing a huge paper explaining why women were treated the way they were in Christian tradition and Bible, and just constantly feeling apologetic. And I think over a period of time, it just got so wearisome, so tiresome, to be forcing everything to fit in this black and white view of the world, so that was just so rigid. There wasn't enough flexibility or openness or creativity or interest anymore to try to make everything forcibly fit. And you can imagine, you know, forcing pieces of a puzzle to fit when they don't. And so to me, it ended up being a matter of integrity to just let go and to stop that. It felt very much like just being true to myself and being honest. Mm.
But it must have been hard, too, I suppose, to turn your back on what had been so much an all-encompassing system of belief for so many years.
I imagine that's very difficult. Very difficult and painful.
Yes.
I mean, I think of Jesus as my first lover. So, yes, very painful. I mean, to acknowledge the validity of other religions, you know, that Jesus wasn't the only person that's taught people a lot. That's why it was a sincere struggle for many years. And at present, when people read my book or even family members come to the conclusion that I was not a real Christian in the first place, and that's why I've gotten it all wrong now, I disagree totally with that. I was a Christian in the deepest way.
And so after that decision, even though you say it takes years for it to become real, is there a grieving for the loss?
Definitely, and I realized that too when I had done some writing of poetry and done some artwork. I could see the grief in my artwork. I didn't realize I was mourning, but I was definitely mourning.
In what ways has it shown itself in your artwork?
Oh, I wrote a poem about my chocolate god who had melted and become sticky and something to get rid of, and kind of the loss of childhood innocence, the fairyland candy view of God, the childish view of God as a Santa Claus type of character, and knowing that it was very wonderful. You know, I would like to have chocolate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I had to give that up. In my poem, I ended up talking about eating salad, and on some days, I just don't want my salad, I want the chocolate. Because it was pretty nice to have all the answers and all the comforts of that.
And Marlene, is there ongoing pain from that choice that you made? Misunderstanding, hurt?
There's still some pain and some awkwardness in family relationships. I think for myself, I've done enough growing to where I no longer have some of those same feelings about losing my chocolate daddy. But I think those are some of the issues that I face now are similar to what all humans face, the idea of being a grown-up and being responsible for my own life. And that simply trying to find God and ask Him what to do on a daily basis is not something that I really have the option of.
Radio National, The Search for Meaning, Caroline Jones with you, and I'm speaking with Dr. Marlene Winnell, who's author of a book called Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. When you leave one framework of meaning, are you then searching out another framework or seeking to construct one?
I don't think that that's paramount at first. And this is from basically my own experience and then listening to the people that I've interviewed and clients that I've had. I've ended up with a developmental kind of view that you go through stages often, and maybe the first stage is more of a shedding, a letting go, maybe even some fury and annoyance with the whole subject of religion and spirituality,
yes.
Not wanting to say the word God, and sometimes some fear, some anxiety. I've had people tell me that they can't even park in a church parking lot without breaking down. So often, sometimes there's a big avoidance. And then gradually going through some processes, grief and anger and reconciliation with different things. And then finally realizing that there have to be some replacements. You do need to replace what you used to have with something.
Yes.
And I don't think you know that you need to do that or that you know you're even in that process for some time.
But that's what you're doing.
Definitely.
So I'd love to know what have been some of the sources of a new framework of meaning. You've mentioned art, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been very important? I mean, your own expression in art?
Well, the whole area of creativity has been very important.
Yes.
And that would be something that I think of in terms of spirituality. I know for myself, some of the times when I am most at peace and most alive are times when I am being creative. And that's a very exciting thought, and I remind myself of that sometimes. If I'm not doing well, if I'm depressed or sad, I ask myself, what are you doing these days that's feeling creative? And if there's some kind of a problem in that area, it's often a good explanation.
Yeah.
This is actually a radical thought. If you come from a very rigid fundamentalist background, it may be obvious to other people, but if you're raised thinking that God is the creator and you are the creation, and there are verses in the Bible about God being the potter and you are the clay, and you are molded and you do not answer back to the potter. I mean, there's a whole passage like that. And while that may have a point in terms of humility and so forth, still, I think that it takes a while to realize that you can also be a creator or a co-creator at least.
Mm.
That you have that in you. Even that you have anything in you. Because I think the best you can hope for in the fundamentalist framework is that you be a clean channel.
So.
You know, hollow for God to use you. You're never supposed to think that you have anything in you. So doing creative things is a very different and exciting area of life to discover. But it comes back to what I was saying about trusting the self, too, and allowing creative things to come forth and be evoked, and trusting that process. Another time when I feel very similar is when I'm with a client as a psychologist, and I'm, because my philosophy in doing therapy is an evocative one. I believe that what I'm doing is evoking the health and growth in this individual. I'm not the source of it. I'm not giving advice. I'm not a guru. But I'm supporting. The model would probably be most like a gardener than anything else. I'm watering and providing sunshine and so forth, but I'm not doing the actual growing or blossoming. And I'm sometimes very honored to be watching the process.
And what is the essence of that? I can understand that part of that is listening.
Listening and believing in the person, sometimes at a time when they've lost their own belief. I think a good therapist can step in and provide some of that faith and confidence until you regain it for yourself.
So.
And take over for yourself. So it's an empowering kind of thing. The other thing, that word that comes to mind is just love. It's funny, it sounds pretty corny, but when I think about what I do in therapy is I love people. That to me comes down to a lot of very specific strategies and things that I do, but it's largely an attitude and a caring, and I think that what people take away is that there is such a thing and that they can then learn to love themselves.
Mm. Yes, you see, I wanted to ask you, when you leave the fold of a fundamentalist religious background, will the religion let you go so easily?
Mm.
It sounds as though you still sometimes have to wrestle with some of the old beliefs, at least, with which you were indoctrinated. Is that a fair word to use?
Yes.
Which you were taught, at least.
Yeah, and I've also noticed that some of the basic assumptions of traditional Christianity are assumptions that seem to be true in society more generally, and that often people who've had no contact with the church are still making some of these assumptions, and institutions will support these things, such as being inherently wrong and expecting people to earn their worth, expecting children to be bad. Punishing criminals, you know, they're competitive kinds of things, or the way we treat the earth as if we're leaving, which is a perfectly biblical attitude, to subdue the earth and then assume that someday it's going to blow up anyhow.
Yes, and holding that view, I suppose, absolves you of worrying too much about another conflict breaking out in the Middle East or wherever.
Yeah.
Because
oh,
you
yeah.
have the expectation anyhow that the end times are near. Is
oh,
that right?
It is,
in the fundamentalist viewpoint?
There was a time there that it was, I was still going to church less often, but I was still going when the Six-Day War broke out in the Middle East, and our pastor was thrilled and held up the headlines of the newspaper and for the congregation to see, and he was very much into end times kinds of thinking and was thrilled, and I think the congregation clapped, and it was just horrifying.
Mm. It wasn't then, but it is to you now, as you look
well,
back.
It was. That was towards the end of my church going, and I mean, it was one of these experiences where you just feel something is very wrong here.
Yes.
Why are we happy about war?
But to him, it was the end times, and therefore mm-hmm. the second coming, and therefore the time when folk of his belief would be raptured up to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, saved.
And then Jesus and his angels would be back and would straighten out the world.
Right.
And start over.
So although you've now altogether moved away from an understanding of the Bible as being literally the Word of God, are there some passages that stay with you or that are still illuminating or that you can intertwine with your own experience mm-hmm. and find beautiful?
Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Luke 12:27.
What does that one say to you?
Well, those are Jesus' words. I think it's about being beautiful and good in essence and not because of doing or trying or earning or external things. When he talks about Solomon, I think he's talking about Solomon's costume. It's like when Jesus confronted the disciples when they were arguing about who was going to be greatest in the kingdom and brought in a little child. And said, this is the greatest, and if you want to be in my kingdom, you must be like this.
Mm.
And that's a very essential thing about children. They just are. They haven't been indoctrinated to think that they have to earn anything. And the last one is, but Jesus said, let the children come to me, and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 19:14.
Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody searching.
And Marlene, do you find your own children teaching you?
My children have taught me so much. It's amazing. I have a 12-year-old who, since he was born, has been teaching me things. And that's intriguing to me and absolutely wonderful. He thinks that he's learning all kinds of good things from me, but I think it's the other way around. For example, we were talking about miracles one time because I have a family member who's very enamored of miracles, healings, and other astonishing works of God. And my son piped up and said, well, you know, I think a miracle would be if in a poor neighborhood everybody got together and decided to make a playground for the children. And they all pitched in to make the playground and build the equipment. I think that would be a true miracle. And he said this when he was 10. Oh, I agreed, but you just put it so well.
So what are some of the ways in which you would now express your philosophy of life?
Well, I use the term existential humanistic, and when I talk about my philosophy and psychology and psychotherapy, and I think that that's probably a good term. The existential part has to do with being present and awake and alive, noticing my life instead of having it just pass and wondering what happened, the humanistic part has to do with hope and believing, trusting what is within every human being, including myself, and caring about that. It's taken me a long time to really care about the world, because I think as a fundamentalist, you get taught that it's not worth saving. It's going to burn. And social change efforts or political efforts or anything are just not worth it. They consider it worth it to save individuals, but not to really care about the world or be involved. The humanism for me is that caring and that faith in humans. One source of huge relief for me leaving the fold was being allowed to appreciate and love people for who they are instead of for their category. Within fundamentalism, people are either saved or damned. And so you relate to somebody positionally in terms of what position they are in relation to God. So they are either an object of conversion or an object of fellowship. And I was very familiar with that consciousness.
And I guess you have no longer that feeling of original sin in people,
right?
Do you?
No. So when I talk to somebody new, or what's of interest to me is to learn what is special about this person. Another aspect of being spiritual to me is paying attention to the daily small things. That spiritual doesn't mean something unusual that you are in touch with once in a while or on Sundays or when you think about God. Spiritual can be just how you are living your life, living with intentionality, doing things that fit with what I say my values are, living in harmony, living with some humility. And again, my best examples are my children, and very small children. I love spending time at preschools and kindergartens and hanging out with little children, and with a lot of the clients that I've had, I highly recommend it, and I give it as homework because it really just takes you back to your core.
Yes.
And also the whole approach of thinking about the inner child that you have. I said earlier that a very difficult thing about being human is the sense of responsibility, the freedom and responsibility that we have as human beings. But thinking about that as a nurturing parent, taking care of this wonderful, delightful inner child who is very curious and life-loving and wanting to go out there and do things, but needs some protection and care, is a very doable way of thinking about it.
Inner child, you mean my inner child?
Your inner child.
You mean, yes, that aspect of me.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, it takes the heaviness, I think, out of it, and yet keeps you responsible. I mean, there's been a lot about the inner child in pop psychology.
Yes.
But sometimes people leave it there, you know, getting in touch with your inner child and leave it there. With the work that I do, I like to also help a person get in touch with the loving grown-up there, the adult, that will love and care for that child and make sure that that child is getting its needs met.
Yes.
And that's a wonderful process. That's an exciting, delightful thing to do.
So what do you now think is the basic human task? There's a question for you.
The basic human task. The job of taking responsibility for ourselves in a loving kind of way. Not being afraid of the freedom we have. A lot of systems, not just fundamentalism, but many systems, are really an escape from that freedom, because it's very comfortable to have somebody else be dictating everything.
Yes, you could say it of a political party, I suppose.
Institutions.
Oh,
yeah. Sure, a lot of political groups are very dogmatic. And New Age systems of thought can be very dogmatic. All kinds of things can.
Yes.
So it's easy, it's comfortable to give away those responsibilities for thinking and feeling for yourself. So taking on the task of being a human being, having some courage to go about that, making the choices, both the big choices, the commitments in your life, and the daily choices. I mean, you could see life as just a continuous series of choices. So to embark on that journey, hopefully with some joy.
Yes.
And not be afraid. It often comes down to courage a lot of times, I think. Because if you leave fundamentalism or any other dogmatic system, it's not going to work to simply buy into another one or to ask somebody else to tell you what to do. You eventually have to dig down and figure out how you're going to do that for yourself.
Yes. So is there God for you in any sense now?
I would have to reject that notion of God if it has anything to do with the judgmental, patriarchal God of traditional Christianity. But if we're talking about a God which is not only transcendent and out there, but also within and emanative, in other words, that it's not just the higher power, but maybe deeper power, and that something like an aquifer where we can all deep down touch within ourselves and maybe touch the same thing. I don't know. Very much a mystery. When I think of God, I think of her as being, I'll say her, as just being a lot bigger than I was ever taught. A lot bigger and full of complexity and mystery. And as soon as we think we know what God is, we're probably wrong because it's something else.
Yes. But neither complexity nor mystery frighten you now or worry you now.
That's what makes life interesting.
Mm.
To me, it would seem very boring now to have a system where I had all the answers. So while that may be very comforting, it just does not have the potential, the open pathways to choose from. Not that there aren't hard times. I mean, the human dilemma is not an easy one. I mean, there aren't plenty of times when I would rather turn over the reins to somebody else or have the answers or not have to worry about death. I mean, that's something that we face, our own mortality, our own aging, a lot of issues that we still have to deal with. So that's why I said it keeps coming back to courage and finding the joy in some of those struggles, not expecting it to necessarily be easy all the time.
I was thinking about fundamentalism and humor. You know, there seems, anyhow, from my reading of it, to be little room for humor or irony or a sense of the absurd. Would that be true? I mean, and do you experience life differently now as far as humor is concerned?
Actually, and I think back on it, I think it's interesting that I did have a sense of humor, and that may have been helpful to me in helping me get out. Yeah, I think there are good reasons why fundamentalists don't have a great sense of humor, because control is so important. Control. That's why they're afraid of so many things. Any kind of altered states, any kind of, all kinds of information, even relaxation techniques. Often when you think about it, when we laugh at something, it's because it's the unexpected, it's out of control in some way. And when we laugh at ourselves or laugh at human beings, it's with that kind of ironic attitude that really does not fit with a belief system that is so rigid, that has all those kinds of, all the answers.
Yes.
Well, some of my thinking lately, and since writing the book, I've been thinking more about more global issues and more issues having to do with human relationships and interventions on educational levels, teaching of tolerance, ecological issues in the world. I think that the world is headed for disaster if we don't pull together. And, you know, again, that may sound rather cliched, but this sense of responsibility that I was talking about is not just a personal one. It's also a collective one. We are not only responsible for ourselves, but in a sense, we are our brother's keeper. We do need to have a larger sense of responsibility. And that's been something that I've thought about and I've been thinking about. My husband and I were chatting about this, and he's had this background in talking about change agents, guerrilla change agents, in that everything you do every day can be a positive contribution. I hope I'm not going back to any kind of missionary mentality. I don't think so. But I think in terms of a sense of meaning and purpose in the world, that's been very important. And I mean that in a very concrete kind of way, too. For example, if I think that there's child abuse going on down the street, that is my business.
And what do you hope that your book, Leaving the Fold, might do? What contribution would you hope it would make?
I'm hoping that people who have left their religion, not just fundamentalism, although that's what I focused on, can find this book useful in clarifying what some of the issues are. A lot of times it's the lack of having names of terms, not knowing what the trouble is that is most painful for people. They may have stopped going to church, or they may have rejected their parents' religion, and they don't know what it is they're going through, why they're so confused, or why so angry, or why so sad, and or even what some steps are that might help. So just clarifying some of those issues and pointing some direction, I think, is what I'm trying to do. And also, I think I'm making the point that this isn't just about extreme cults. I mean, we can look at situations like Waco and so forth and shake our heads, but it's also some of these mind control methods and some of this robbing of emotional and personal responsibility goes on in many a neighborhood church. So in that sense, I don't expect my book to be welcome in a lot of circles. The other thing that I hope is that people in helping positions, therapists or otherwise, will find it a resource.
And the book in question is Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion, published by New Harbinger Publications. Dr. Marlene Winnell has written it from her own experience and from clinical practice as a psychologist. Marlene holds a doctorate in human development and family studies. She lives in Brisbane with her husband and two children. Her book is distinguished by an intelligent approach which fully acknowledges the benefits of an authentic religious education, as well as the pitfalls of certain forms of religious indoctrination which rob the individual of personal responsibility and integrity and the exercise of reason. An important question to contemplate today, when fast-changing, complex, uncertain times make simple answers very appealing, especially to the young, and when fundamentalist thinking is found not only in religion, but in economics and politics and nationalism too. The Search for Meaning explores variations of this theme each week. The program can be heard Sunday evenings after Insights and the News at 6:05, and on Friday afternoons after the News at 2. Producer Stephen Godley, with assistance from Cecily Doig and Jeremy Moore. This is Caroline Jones. I hope you'll join me next time.